Today's Teisho will be on case 89 in the Book of Serenity. Case 89 is entitled Dongshan's No Grass. Introduction. Move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move and sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and let the middle go. Then you must buy some sandals and travel some more before you'll really attain realization. Case. Dongshan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you brethren, will go, some to the east, some west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He also said, "But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go?" Shi Shuang said, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." Dayong said, "I'd say not even going out the gate. Still, the grass is boundless." Verse. Grass boundless. Inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look. How many kinds? For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into scars of burning. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning and sitting so still. This really deep, deep practice is so essential. You know, when you sit down on the cushion first time you ever try this, you know, it's very difficult to focus on your breath. And you try to focus on the breath, and your thoughts sweep you down the river of thoughts. And you eventually realize you're not watching your breath, and you come back to your breath. You try to watch the breath, and it sweeps you down the stream of thoughts and memories. And then you pull yourself back up to the breath. And this can go on for a long time, really. And in fact, it's many years before you can just effortlessly sit down and things will be different. And you can make a great deal of progress while you're still sometimes struggling with to get past your thoughts on the cushion. But eventually, if you continue to watch your breath, eventually you will reach a point which is non-dualistic awareness. We call it samadhi, sanmai, ding. And when you enter sanmai, when you enter samadhi, you may not notice it at first, but you'll eventually appreciate that condition, you know, where it's as though you have found something in yourself that is still and grounded and that doesn't move, right? And, you know, after you've had that experience, your next sit may be, you may be back to the condition of trying to push through your thoughts to get back to the breath and so on. But eventually, if you persist, if you sit like we sat today, right, and you do this regularly, you know, you will find that samadhi place that still is like a still unmoving place. And eventually you'll be able to get to that place quite often, right? In fact, you know, eventually if you practice long enough, when you sit down on the cushion, it won't take you long at all to get to that place. It might just be you sit down, you start watching your breath, and then you're there. That takes a lot of practice. After you've had your first experience of samadhi, you know, the next sit may be disappointing. You may be all over the place. Eventually, you know, you'll get back to samadhi. And every time you get back to samadhi, it's like you're relearning the path to samadhi. And eventually when you sit down on the cushion, you get right away into this still, grounded place, see. So if this hasn't happened to you yet, you know, please persist. Because when you get to samadhi, it's the most beautiful feeling in the world. You know, we're pulled in this direction and that direction. You know, you get up in the morning and you read, maybe you're a news junkie and you read the news. The news is always lately very upsetting and confusing. Or maybe your daily life is just very hectic. You know, if you're not careful, your whole life will be lost just chasing the next moment. You know, so don't let that happen to you. You know, it's so easy to live from moment to moment, chasing the next moment. There's so much to do every day, right? We have to get up. We have to take a shower. You have to get to work. You know, work is this endless stream of demands and challenges. You know, you get home and maybe you have a family, and that's also very, you know, you can go your whole life just going from moment to moment. And sometimes you just feel like there's no place that's calm and centered. So, you know, if you make time, even though you have a busy schedule, if you make time to practice Chan, to practice Zen, you know, eventually you get into this state of samadhi. It's like an unmoving place. It's like the eye of a hurricane, right? You know, a hurricane is a vortex of high energy wind, right? And of course, that if you're in that vortex, it tears the roof off your house and so on. But at the center of the vortex, everything is still and calm and bright, right? So please don't. Please, now that you've found an interest in Zen, now that you're interested in this, please don't spend the rest of your life being tossed on the waves of that stream of thought, right? Don't allow your life to slip by like that. You know, if you can ground yourself in samadhi, you know, you suddenly have this, even in the midst of absolute craziness, you know, you can sit down, even if it's just in a chair, and you can watch your breath, and you feel yourself going down into samadhi, and it's as though you can suddenly, it's like, it's become, as things get tenser and tenser, even drawing a breath is a challenge, right? You know, when you enter samadhi, it's like there's this great spaciousness. Even in the midst of all this confusion, there's this unmoving centeredness, right? And this is so beautiful and so wonderful, right? So if you haven't had this experience yet, you know, please persist, and this experience will definitely present itself to you. And as I say, if you have it once and you expect it the next time, you may be disappointed, but if you continue to cultivate your big mind, you know, you will eventually be able to get to that place very quickly. You know, I can remember when I was training with my shifu, my roshi, Genki, and, you know, I asked him how long it would take me. An hour and a half to get into samadhi. You know, it would take me a long time, many sits. By the end of that, I would get into samadhi. And then, you know, sometimes I didn't get into samadhi after three sits. So at one point, I was at our temple, and I was preparing breakfast. We used to have collect communal breakfast in the morning. And each of us had the responsibility for cooking a breakfast one day a week. It would rotate, like every 2 weeks you'd be assigned the breakfast duty. And it was my breakfast duty, and so I was cooking breakfast. And Genki Roshi got up and he came into the kitchen just to help me wrap things up. And I said to him in the kitchen, how long does it take you to get into samadhi? He says, as soon as I sit down, I'm in samadhi. So, you know, seemed impossible at the time, but eventually samadhi sort of becomes your baseline condition. And in fact, you know, for a while in Zen, you'll have a situation where you can get into samadhi on the cushion, but you're often not in samadhi off the cushion. And so, you know, you can achieve a great stillness on the cushion, but then, you know, when you have to go home and, you know, the dishwasher breaks and your teenage daughter is giving you a hard time and so on, you know, you may find you're not able to get into samadhi. It's okay, it happens to everybody, but, you know, eventually you may have this experience where the sit is over, you know, you walk outside and you realize I'm still in samadhi. You know, eventually samadhi becomes more and more your baseline condition of mind. So this is all sort of like a sequence that you will fall if you stick with it and you practice. I can't tell you how wonderful samadhi is, so please do. But, you know, actually, eventually, once you can enter samadhi, that's not enlightenment. That's just a very beautiful state of awareness. If you are practicing Zen, you know, the teacher will say, you know, watch your breath. And when you follow the breath out and you enter samadhi, there's something more for you to notice. It's like you follow the breath out and you eventually become one with the breath. See, that's when we usually begin to enter samadhi. But there's something else to notice. At the end of the breath, when you follow the breath out, and this takes maybe months or even years of practice, you begin to notice that your mind at the end of your breath becomes blank or dark. See, this is not a unimportant event. This is like a karmically transformative event. You know, the first time it happens to you, you might not think much of it, right? You might not think much of it, but it's crucially important. You know, in Zen, this is called Wu Xin, Wu Xin, Wu Xin. Mind of emptiness, or in Japanese it's called mushin, mushin. So once you can enter samadhi, if your teacher is doing her job or his job, the teacher will not let you linger in samadhi, but will direct your attention to that blankness at the end of your breath or at the core of your consciousness. Really, it's at the core of your consciousness. And if you focus on that emptiness, at first it's just like this, over in a flash. And you may just be watching your breath and all of a sudden you notice this blankness and then you go back to your breath, or you may be directed at that blankness by your teacher. In Zen practice, the teacher will often say, focus on the word wu or the word mu. So that's called the mu koan. You will sit down on the cushion and you'll say, on your out-breath silently to yourself. You will say, moo, 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 or woo, woo, woo. See, it's no, 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 or empty, nothing, 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 see. So you know, if you just keep focusing on that sound and directing your attention to the blankness, you know, eventually that blankness becomes not trivial and not instantaneous, but becomes vast, vast emptiness. See, it's like we at first think our consciousness is just our senses and our thoughts, right? That's how we think about things. It seems so clear that, you know, the world of our senses is all there is, all there is. And, you know, if we're having trouble with our lives, or if we're suffering from anxiety issues, or we feel we have questions about what the purpose of being alive is, we might try to learn Zen meditation. You know, when you decide to learn Zen meditation, you know, you may get to samadhi, and then you may enter deep wuxin, and you may feel better, right? And that blankness may just seem like something that happens briefly. As I say, if you persist in practicing, the character of that blankness changes, and eventually the deeper you go into that blankness, or the longer you stay in that blankness, that emptiness, it's sort of like the deeper and vaster it becomes, see. And this is like a major milestone in your practice, getting to that place where emptiness becomes something you can access or enter. And then the more you can enter that emptiness, the deeper it becomes, the vaster it becomes. And you'll notice that when you go into that emptiness and you come out of that emptiness, everything feels so much better, so much more wonderful. So I have been doing this for a long time, for almost 50 years. And I have had so many experiences where I have been, upset about something, or sad about something, disappointed, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath for a little while, and you go into that emptiness, there's like a transformation. When you get off the cushion and you walk outside, it's like a new world. It's so beautiful. Everything is so alive, right? And, you know, we don't necessarily give much thought as to why this is the case. It's the most wonderful thing. You know, in Buddhist literature, sometimes there's this term, wish-fulfilling gem, wish-fulfilling jewel, right? And, I would say that emptiness, shunyata is what it's called in Sanskrit, wuxin, is like a wish-fulfilling jewel. It's like, you know, when the world is gray and an awful place to be, and you sit down on the cushion, yeah, and you watch your breath, and you spend a half an hour or an hour or some period of time on the cushion, and you're meditating, and some of that period of time is in emptiness, and you get off the cushion, everything is now like in color. It was gray and colorless, and now it's in color, and it's vibrant and alive, right? So this is really, this experience is, if you haven't had that experience yet, because you're relatively new to meditation practice, please hang in there, because it's the most amazing thing, right? So all of this is sort of like the backdrop or the background to this koan, okay? So if you're relatively new to koans, koans are generally brief stories that involve usually one or two teachers, a Zen student and his teacher, or two teachers, and it usually records a moment or describes a moment when someone has a breakthrough in her practice or in his practice. So it's like someone is stuck in her practice, and the teacher says something to the student, and the student suddenly has like a breakthrough. And it's like that experience I just described, where everything is gray and depressing, and then suddenly, after getting off the cushion, it's all alive and, you know, in this beautiful colored, vibrant color, right? So these koans are like moments of awakening or moments of insight, little stories. And in this one, the teacher's name is Dongshan. And in China and later in Japan, the year of practice was organized into what Japanese people call ango, or it's like semester. It's like a semester in our culture. So basically, at the end of the semester, we're ending spring semester here at Rutgers. The last exam will be on Friday. Everybody leaves for the summer, you know. Temple life was kind of like that too, right? At the end of an ango, people would leave the temple. Sometimes they might go traveling. Sometimes they might go to their home, their families. They also might return to their local temples. So actually, not all the monks at Dongshan's temple lived at Dongshan's temple. Some of them had local temples, and they were the local Chan, the local Zen monk, right? And they would take care of the needs of their communities. And then, you know, basically they would, when Sesshin was scheduled, we have a Sesshin coming up at the end of this month. When Sesshin was scheduled, they would leave their local temples where they were in charge, and they would come to the teaching temple, in the Dongshan's temple, and they would do Chanqi. They would do a Sesshin, see. And at the end of a period of Sesshins, like there would be like a spring semester, there would be like Sesshin every month or something, Sesshin every 2 months. At the end of that period, the monks would leave and go back to their local temples or travel, go to their family home. So Dongshan is saying, you know, it's the beginning of autumn and the end of the summer. So we've finished the summer semester, right? And the winter ango has not yet started. And you brethren will go some to the east, some to the west. So, you know, he's saying, as you're traveling, you know, please go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, see? So the way you would practice with this koan is you would go into that blankness, or you would go into samadhi, and then you would say the turning phrase, in this case, no grass. No, the teacher will give you the turning phrase. So you sit down on the cushion, you read the story several times, and then you just say, no grass, no grass, no grass. And you just keep going back into emptiness. And eventually, some kind of a response presents itself. See? The thing is, you know, Dongshan basically is saying goodbye for the semester to his monks. And he's saying, don't forget about emptiness. Don't forget to go into emptiness, see. You know, you're going to get on the train. They didn't have trains, but you're going to get on the train for Suzhou or Shanghai or, you know, Tokyo, you know. And he said, you know, you're going to go see your family. You're going to go back to your local temple. Don't forget about emptiness. Well, that's kind of a strange thing, see, for a teacher to say to students, to monks, right, who have all, who very accomplished, all of his monks know how to get into emptiness. Why would he say this? Why would he say, go where there's not a blade of grass and an absolute emptiness, see? So most koans have like a complication or a hook, right? So the complication here is that, you know, they already know about emptiness. So what's he telling them? Right? So, you know, the way to answer this is not to try to figure it out. The way to respond to the koan is to go into deep wuxin, deep wuxin, deep empty mind and say, no grass, no grass. So, you know, basically, we think, if we've been practicing Zen for a while, we think that there's something, which is, we say, like the world of form. And the world of form is, you know, like your job, your house, you know, after sitting today, you'll probably have lunch or you'll have dinner, right? You know, you might have to go to the shop, right, and get some food. You might have an empty refrigerator. So that's the world of form. That's real, and it's substantial. You know, you can touch it. You can eat a, you know, carrot when you get home, or you can eat a sandwich when you get home. And then there's emptiness, right? So there's something and there's nothing. There's something and there's nothing. And you think, oh, well, that makes perfect sense, see? Anybody who's done Zen for a while knows there's something and there's nothing. Right? And, you know, it's possible to spend a lot of time and think that's a good description of reality. But actually, this actually confused description of reality, believe it or not. It's actually confused. Because what we call reality is real in a limited way, but actually much more limited than we realize. You could almost say what we call reality is not real. It's not real. Right? We could say there's something and there's nothing, but what we call something is not real. It feels real. It seems real, and everybody else is doing the same thing. So it, you know, we are reinforced in our assumption that it's real. But, you know, actually what we call reality is like a tiny, tiny, tiny slice of reality. It's so small, it's so small you could almost say it's unreal. We think of maybe this world, you know, the sandwich, the house payments, this is real. And emptiness, we might say, is, you know, maybe like death or something like that, you know. But actually, it's the other way around, you know. The world we call real is really not real. You could almost say it's a little bit dead. This is kind of shocking to say, but it's almost like a little bit dead. And the emptiness, you know, actually is very much alive. So you might say, you know, the real is a living and emptiness is dead. But actually, it's not like that at all, you know. If you have ever had, maybe you've had this experience of doing the same thing over and over and over again, right? And sometimes we do things over and over and over again, and we enjoy them every time, but very often it happens where we do something, we do the same thing the next day, we do the same thing, and each time we do it, it becomes a little less alive, right? It becomes a little less alive, right? And I think that happens to most people in their life. My wife had a job in Seattle working for an import company. And it was a really exciting job. Her background is in like art and art history. And she got this job working for this Japanese import company. And you know, at first it was, everything was new. It was so exciting. You know, she, you know, these incredibly beautiful things would come in from Japan, ceramics, like beautiful Chinese ceramics and Japanese ceramics and fabrics, you know, these incredible, Japanese have these incredible fabrics, right? You know, so, you know, at first, like first couple of years, this job was like a dream job, right? You know, she'd order, she'd go to these trade shows. She had all these friends who were Japanese or Japanese American, and you know, buying these things for the store. You know, like 8 years later, it was just, she just could not, it was so hard to go to those shows, right? It was just so hard. It would seem like this wonder world at first, and then repetition. It was like the life drained out of it, right? I think that when that happens, it's not a personal defect at all. I think that when that happens, we're beginning to see the limitations of our reality, right? Of our so-called reality, you know? We're beginning to see how small our world really is, you know? How it's like a little tiny slice of reality. When people go through that kind of experience of being like so excited and then repeating over and over and over again the same thing and saying, you know, this, I just don't think I can go to one more trade show. If I have to look at one more piece of Japanese cloth or one more Japanese tea cup, you know, I'm going to scream. That's actually a good thing. Because basically, I would say we're beginning to see how small our world really is. And, you know, when people have experiences like that, you know, sometimes they begin to look around for something else. You know, maybe they take up painting or, some people come to practice meditation. And some people learn how to enter samadhi and learn how to enter emptiness. And you know, if I say to people who don't know anything about Buddhism or anything about Zen, you know, one of the kind of meditation we do is mostly emptiness meditation. You know, their faces, they look crestfallen or frightened. It's like, that sounds terrible, right? That sounds emptiness meditation. It sounds so terrible, right? When people in the West think about emptiness in the Western cultural sphere, they think of it as the absence of life or the absence of anything. They think about emptiness as almost like death. So when I say to people who don't know anything about Buddhism or anything about meditation, we meditate on emptiness, it's like saying, oh, we meditate on death, right? We definitely don't meditate on death. In fact, we meditate on life. But life isn't The trade show, I mean, part of life is the trade show, yes. It's a small part of life. And, you know, the biggest part of life is the part we can't see and the part we don't know. See, so that's, I think, really important to remember. This is why when we sit down on the cushion and we enter deep wuxin, deep emptiness, we don't feel dead, we feel so alive. We feel so alive. And when we get off the cushion, you know, things that seemed dead to us, right? You know, your backyard, it's the same old backyard every day, you mow it once a week. You know, if you've been meditating for an hour and a half and you go out and you look, it's like every blade of grass is alive. See, in some ways, what we call reality is can be the least alive part of our lives. Yes, that's true. And what we call emptiness can be the most alive part of our lives. You know, it's like I have rather significant nearsightedness, right? So, you know, I've had nearsightedness since I was a little kid. When I was in the second grade, all the other kids would start taking notes off the board, and I would have to get up and walk up to the board so I could take notes like in math class. And my teacher, seeing me do this, wrote a note to my mother and said, "I think your son has a vision problem." And I went to the eye doctor, and I was like five, and he gave me a pair of glasses because I was nearsighted. You know, if I hadn't had those glasses, I never would have known how little I was seeing, right? Because it all seemed like I was seeing everything there was to see. When I put the glasses on, it's like, oh my God, I didn't realize I wasn't seeing all this stuff. I have, when I was a younger young man, I used to work in building trades, you know, so I used to work with as a union carpenter for a while. I worked on construction sites all through college. So I have a hearing loss, right? But, you know, for years I didn't know how much hearing I had lost, right? Because, I could function. Now, you know, when I said, "Can I hear?" I felt like I could hear. And then I actually went for an ear hearing test. And then I put on my, you know, I have like these almost invisible hearing aids. And it's like, oh my God, I haven't been hearing any of this, see. So, you know, actually conventional reality is a lot like that. You know, it feels real. It's like I'm hearing everything that's going on. And you put the hearing aids in, it's like, oh my God. You know, I remember when I got my new hearing aids from Costco, let me just say they're very good hearing aids. You know, I turned on the taps in my bathroom, and for years I had not heard the water going down the drain. I'd forgotten. It was like, oh, that's so beautiful. The water's flowing down the drain, see? Our reality feels complete and real no matter how small it gets. And yet, you know, the good thing is that as it gets smaller and smaller, you know, sometimes we begin to feel this is very lifeless. You know, this has become very lifeless. And that's not discontentment. You know, that's not discontentment. That's like your big mind is telling you something is missing from your life, right? You don't know what it is. Just like before I had my glasses, I didn't know what I wasn't seeing. Before I got my hearing aids, I didn't know what I wasn't hearing. You know, but our conventional reality is very small, and it's easy to get to think that's all there is to reality. The biggest part of reality is not the part we can see or know. It's the part we can't see yet and don't know yet. See? And so, you know, going into emptiness is not going into the void. It's not going into death. It's like reality is this small little patch in front of Yosemite, right? You know, it's like, so when we go into emptiness, it's like we're connecting with the bigger whole, the bigger connect, the bigger unity, right? And when we bring that back into our everyday lives, everything comes alive, see? You know, I don't know if you've ever seen shadow puppets. You know, in Indonesia, they have this beautiful tradition of a shadow puppet theater. And basically, it's not like our theater. The stage, there's like a stage like in Chinese theater, but it's a little different. Because at the front of the part, you're looking into the stage. It's not an open stage. It's a piece of waxed paper, right? And it's got a little bit of a golden hue, right? It's like waxed paper, and you can see through it. And behind the paper, there's a candle, big candle. And then the puppets are between the candle and the waxed paper, see? So when you watch this puppet show, you can Google it. It's the Balinese puppets. When you Google it, what happens is that at first the screen is bright and golden, luminous. And then along comes the hero, you know, Krishna, right? And then Sita or somebody like that on the other side, and Ravana and so on. We begin to tell a little story, but you don't see the whole, you just see the outlines of the figures, right? No, I think this is a beautiful model of reality, right? Because, you know, actually the world we see and call real, this is like these are the shadows. They're wonderful, but they're shadows. It's like the light is not getting through completely, yeah? And the reality is the light behind the shadows, yeah? And the light behind the shadows becomes accessible to us when we go into emptiness. And we lose track of the light behind the shadows when we become too obsessed with what we call reality. If that doesn't make any sense, just hang on, you know, just keep practicing. I'm not saying that the world is totally unreal and you don't have to pay your mortgage. But I'm saying that it's a small part of a bigger whole. And the wholeness of things is not available to us except through emptiness. It's like when you combine your sandwich with emptiness, now you're bringing your sandwich to life, but you're also experiencing the wholeness beyond your sandwich. You know, if you practice Zen on your very worst day, on your very worst day, and you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep wuxin and you stay there for a while, I promise you that everything will come to life, and your heart, which might be so crushed by circumstances, will leap up into the air, you know, because it's like you will be like a... So often in our lives, because we lose track with the wholeness, you know, we become, have you ever seen a fish out of water on the shore of a gasping for breath, right? We're like that. You know, we're gasping for breath. We don't even know there is an ocean, right? We're just trying to stay alive on the shore. And, you know, one day you experience emptiness, and it's like your world goes from this little square to this vastness. And you can't see the vastness with your eyes and you can't hear the vastness with your ears. But when you see and when you hear, you also feel the vastness, right? And that's why everything comes to life. So Dongshan is saying, you know, if you monks think that there's real and then there's emptiness, you haven't understood the reality and you haven't understood the emptiness, right? That the reality, the emptiness is the reality, and what we call reality is the puppet show, right? Is the show, the movie. You know, basically, you know, emptiness brings life to everything, is sort of the message of this koan. Dongshan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you monks will go, some to the east, some to the west. But you must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. So go into the deepest emptiness, see. And, you know, if you haven't done Zen, you might think, into the deepest emptiness, that sounds terrible. But when you go into the deepest emptiness, it's like everything comes to life. Because life is so much bigger than what we call reality. After he says that, a couple of his fellow Zen masters say this. Shishuang said, going out the gate, immediately there's grass. In other words, as soon as you enter emptiness, you know, the world here doesn't disappear, it comes to life. Dayong says, I'd say even not going out the gate, even before you enter emptiness, the grass is boundless. Verse, grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, you see it for yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. In other words, look, if you have to walk barefoot in a forest of thorns, it's easy compared to the way we often live our lives, which is cut off from the life energy of the universe, right? So until we realize that emptiness is really is life itself, right? What looks dark is actually the luminous screen. We suffer a lot. And after we have made that breakthrough, everything has changed. Look, how many kinds. For while going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. So it's like, you know, life can become, if you don't know about how to enter emptiness, you know, life becomes like a dead forest, right? Just like a dead forest. But, you know, if you can enter emptiness, it's like a spring wind is coming to bring new life to the dead forest, right? So, you know, next time somebody asks you about Zen and you say, we meditate on emptiness, they say, well, we meditate on emptiness to connect with life.